Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
America, there's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it, so let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast for higher education. And that's an appeal to authority. Peace Revolution and all the media we create here at Tragedy and Hope is presented without corporate sponsorship and is provided commercial-free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the members of Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts at TragedyandHope.com. I also encourage you to check out the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at PeaceRevolution.org. And therein you'll also find an invitation to the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein we just finished a pilot project in the form of the Trivium Study Group and are entering into the next stage of education within a community where we'll be conducting the Introduction to Logic Study Group based on the Leonard Peikoff series of lectures. And we're hoping for that to be a video project if Skype cooperates. If you're a Skype user, you know what I mean. Greetings to all of you around the world, and thank you for prioritizing time in your busy schedule to tune in. I'd like to welcome the many new listeners and express my appreciation not only for the subscribers who make these compositions possible, but also for the media partners who help to keep Tragedy and Hope well-rounded and balanced. I wholeheartedly encourage you to sample and subscribe to the myriad of weekly publications within our network of independent media hosts, including James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, Maria Heller of Maria.net, and Jan Irvin of GnosticMedia.com. Together, we're offering you a viable alternative, a more creative and empowering use of your time. And we challenge you to take 1 week off from the same repetitive shows on TV and give yourself a chance to outgrow the status quo. Every one of the aforementioned media hosts likewise offers you a commercial-free media forum, uniquely and creatively meeting your need for information, analysis, and additional perspectives necessary to make informed decisions in today's environment. And speaking of the art of making good judgments, I'd like to share some information with you today that I hope will empower you with the ability to see through the ruses and illusions used to shape our thoughts and actions, and give yourself a real chance to gain some traction, logically and rationally, through this next exercise in focusing our attention. The first 17 episodes of Peace Revolution will help you kind of set the context and provide the basis for systematic critical analysis using the Trivium method, critical thinking. And even if that bar sounds like it's set a little high, I think you'll still appreciate the following presentation. This episode is crafted to act as a lens which removes the blurriness of history which we've all inherited through the education system. It's based on a book by Dr. Stanley Monteith titled The Brotherhood of Darkness, which can be found on his website, radioliberty.com. Now, Monteith's book and the lecture, which is almost a verbatim repetition of the book itself, provides you with an institutional analysis conducted by Professor Carol Quigley over 20 years, which finally was published in 1966 as Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, a 1,300-page book published by Macmillan. To answer the question, who was Carol Quigley? Carol Quigley was born in 1910 and died in 1977, and in between, from 1941 to 1976, Quigley taught at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He also taught at Harvard University, Princeton University, and Georgetown University. Having been himself mentored by a Rhodes Scholar, Quigley most famously among his students is Bill Clinton, who, in his inauguration speech, referred to Carol Quigley and his book and the influence it had on him at a key point in his life. As tempted as I am to imitate Bill Clinton's voice, I'm going to read it straight. As a teenager, I heard John Kennedy's summons to citizenship, and then, as a student at Georgetown, I heard that call clarified by a professor named Carol Quigley, who said to us that America was the greatest nation in history because our people had always believed in two things: that tomorrow can be better than today, and that every one of us has a personal moral responsibility to make it so. What follows is a truly fascinating recount of how Quigley came to write Tragedy and Hope after investing 20 years of his life, and why this book was suppressed. Moreover, the analysis provided by Dr. Monteith is something of an interesting artifact in and of itself, insofar as Monteith's ministry and truth-seeking have led him on a journey to study the private papers left by Carroll Quigley, whereby he painstakingly copied all this contextual metadata from which Tragedy and Hope, the book, was derived. Now, if you're wondering to yourself, is there a connection between Quigley's book and tragedyandhope.com? Well, besides noting that your internal conversation and consequent inquiry are most inspiring to me, you'll note that the inspiration to free suppressed data and to return it to the people who need it, whereby we can all make informed decisions and regain our self-determination and expression of conscious free will, is built into the fabric of tragedyandhope.com, I would say yes. And while I don't see Quigley's work as anything near infallible, it is, in my humble opinion, a very useful central hub. And when connecting this hub to the spokes, metaphorically speaking, through noting that if you connect Quigley's four books to Anthony Sutton's nine books, and connect that with Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins and War is a Racket by Major General Smedley Butler, a pattern starts to emerge as you rotate this around. Progress is made as these perspectives are consumed. And so I've taken the liberty of removing some of the noise in the soundtrack out of this audio, so if you ever see the video version of Monteith's presentation, you'll be able to hear lots of static and other distortion, which I removed to make your learning experience more pleasurable. Lastly, if you just give yourself 15 minutes of patience at the beginning of this lecture, I think you'll find that by 20 or 30 minutes, you'll be thanking yourself for giving Monteith's unique style of presentation the benefit of the doubt. When I first learned about Quigley's Tragedy and Hope through the following presentation back in 2004, it provided serenity. And after attaining and reading Tragedy and Hope, it gave me confidence. That being said, you can download all of Carol Quigley's books in PDF format at carolquigley.net. However, if you use a program like Text Aloud to read to you or make MP3s out of PDFs, you'll note that the Quigley.net files are protected. Working around this obstacle, you can download the unprotected version of Tragedy and Hope, the PDF, at tragedyandhope.com under the Origins tab at the bottom of the page. Within the community, I know that Paul Mozina had recently acquired a copy of Tragedy and Hope and was sent a free book with his order by Renee Wormser, Foundations and Their Influence, an excellent book. And so if you'd like to get a hard copy of Tragedy and Hope, the recent republication makes it easy and affordable. And if you'd like your purchase to help someone whose actions help bring this information to you, please consider buying from Dr. Monteith on his site, radioliberty.com. Now, you'll have to use the telephone to order, as their site is not automated, but the extra effort translates into supporting this little circle of learning that brought us all here today. And I'm pretty sure, having never related any of this to Dr. Monteith himself, he'd likely get a kick out of the irony that you're ordering Tragedy and Hope because you heard a podcast produced by tragedyandhope.com, which started having learned about Tragedy and Hope, the book, from him and his lecture. It's an investment and a first step toward comprehensive understanding. It's not the total, but it's a great first step. And if you think that first step is too much to read, being 1,300 pages, or it costs too much, then start out with War is a Racket by Smedley Butler. It's 35 pages. Certainly easily attainable and affordable these days, and it'll get you started in the right direction, which is understanding the reason that we have this consistent war today is because we all haven't learned the lessons of the root causes which bring this about, which are racism and dehumanization of others in order to be able to justify going and using force to coerce them to do what we want them to do. This is episode 18, A History of the World in Our Time, Origins of Tragedy and Hope. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Tonight I'm going to tell you an amazing, amazing story that is probably quite poorly understood. In fact, much of what we're going to tell you tonight we really haven't gone into before. It's been said that an understanding of the forces which have shaped of the events of the 20th century is predicated not upon facts to be learned, but upon secrets to be discovered. Let me repeat that. An understanding of the forces which have shaped the events of the 20th century is predicated not on facts to be learned, but upon secrets to be discovered. And how do you really understand what indeed has happened during this 20th century? As we see our nation going from crisis to crisis, we see wars and revolutions and disease throughout the world. We see a gradually lowering of American living standards. We see successive administrations, whether they be Republican or Democrat, who refuse to build any sort of a defense for America against nuclear attack. We knew that we've got the Republicans into office, everything was going to be fine. We'd get a balanced budget, we'd cut back on big government, and what have we done? Why, we've actually increased spending for next year and the year after that. In fact, many times the Republicans have been giving more money than the Democratic administration had asked for. And something's seriously wrong. Well, let me try to explain what it is. And as a preface, I'd like to tell you three poems, because these poems have to do with the shaping of our destiny. The first one was written in 1848 by Alfred Lord Tennyson, a British author, one of the greatest authors. He wrote The Charge of the Light Brigade. But he was also part of this belief in the British Empire, this idea that mankind could create a perfect world under Anglo-Saxon domination. The title of the poem is Locksley Hall. And this is what Lord Tennyson wrote. For I dipped into the future, far as any eye could see, saw a vision of the world and all the wonders that would be, heard the heavens filled with shouting, and there rained a ghastly dew of the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue, till the war drums throbbed no longer, and the battlefields were furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. Then the common sense of most will keep the awe in fretful awe, and the kindly earth shall slumber, lapped in universal law. It was a wonderful dream, this idea of a world government under the benevolent rule of world rule through world law. In October of 1993, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And this is what he said. The world of law will not be attained by exhortation. Law requires enforcement. Let's not kid ourselves that we can have a new world order without paying for it in blood as well as in money. Maybe the cost of enforcement will be too great. National interest, narrowly construed, will be a safer rule. But let us recognize that we are surrendering a noble dream. Remember those lines of Tennyson that Churchill called the most wonderful of modern prophecies, and that Harry Truman carried in his wallet throughout his life, and that he quotes this poem that I've just given you. Now, why would Winston Churchill say that that was such a wonderful poem? I mean, wasn't Churchill dedicated to the British Empire? And Harry Truman, why, give him hell, Harry, why did he carry those words in his wallet all of his life? And then you look back to the time of Harry Truman's presidency, when the United Nations Charter was written and confirmed. And then, of course, we offered the Marshall Plan to Europe, because Europe was in danger of going communism, and then we offered the Marshall Plan to the communists. And that didn't quite make sense. And then, of course, China went communist, and Eastern Europe went communist, and then we went into the no-win war in Korea, all under Harry S. Truman, who carried the words to this poem in his wallet all of his life. The second poem I encountered when I went to live in Africa. And in the mid-1970s, I took my family, moved to South Africa, where I taught in a major university. And I was searching at that time, because I'd already heard of Carol Quigley, I'd read his book, and I knew that South Africa had something to do with this move towards world government. And so it was that, driving along the west coast of Southern Africa, there I saw on a hillside this great monument. I didn't know what it was, but I was intrigued by it. I mean, what was this great granite monument doing there, where the pillars almost looked like a small replica of the Lincoln Memorial? And so I climbed the long stairway past row, tier after two, tier of granite lions that were guarding the entrance to this almost shrine. And there, within the portico, you see this great statue, the bust of a man and a pedestal beneath it. And inscribed on that pedestal were these words: "The intense and brooding spirit still shall quicken and control. Living, he was the land, and dead, his soul shall be her soul." Those words were penned by Rudyard Kipling to honor the man who adopted the vision that was put forward in Tennyson's poem. A man who was intent upon bringing world government under Anglo-Saxon domination. His name was Cecil John Rhodes. "The intense and brooding spirit still shall quicken and control." To quicken is to come back to life. "Living, he was the land, and dead, his soul shall be her soul." And let me tell you that there have been many men who wanted to rule the world. I mean, certainly Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great. They say he died because he had no more worlds to conquer. Adolf Hitler, Rousseau. But no one has had more influence on the world than Cecil John Rhodes. And the tragedy is that most people don't understand that almost anything that's going on in the world today has to do with that man. The third poem was written by James Russell Lowell. It was also written in 1848. And it really summarizes the essence of the battle in which we're involved. James Russell Lowell was writing about the crisis of slavery as it faced America and the moral wrong that was going on, and the eternal battle that has always existed between good and evil. And this is what James Russell Lowell said: "Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. And that strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side. Then it is the brave man chooses while the coward stands aside, until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone is strong. Though where portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own." And he was talking about a strife of truth with falsehood. Well, I briefly wanted to mention one of my favorite murder mysteries. And you may wonder what this has to do with the story we're telling you tonight, but it's a story written by Agatha Christie. It's called Murder on the Orient Express. And it's the story of this train line that runs from Istanbul to Paris, and it brings the mystery of the East to the rationalism of the West. And during the early part of the century, this work of fiction tells of this train, and of course there were a number of Americans on it, and there is a Monsieur Perrault, who is a Belgian police officer. He's a Belgian detective. He's the hero of many Agatha Christie murder mysteries, murder stories. And there's a very disreputable American on this train who tells Monsieur Perrault that somebody's trying to kill him, and he wants Monsieur Perrault to protect his life, and he'll give him $5,000. He'll give him $10,000. He's worried about his life. And Monsieur Perrault says, no, I'm not interested. And that night, that very night, this man is murdered. And he's stabbed to death. And there's a question of who did it. And of course, Monsieur Perrault is recruited by the member of the board that controls the railway to find out who the murderer is. And they happen to be trapped in the snowdrift somewhere in the great mountains along the route of the Orient Express. And Monsieur Perrault says, "There are too many clues. There are too many clues." And as we look at the world today, and we see this move towards the New World Order, we sometimes face exactly the same issue. There are just too many clues out there. In fact, we talk to people about what's really behind everything that's going on. And some people will tell you it's the bankers. It's the bankers, because when we have wars, bankers make money. And if you read Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, on page 324, he'll tell you how the central bankers are working in concert to create a feudalistic system by which they'll control the nations of the world by financial flow, and they're doing it secretly, and the banks are working all together. And people will tell you it's the bankers, and other people say, it's not the bankers, it's the Jewish bankers. It's the Jewish bankers, and they will tell you that the Federal Reserve has two types of stock, Class A and Class B, and all this money is going overseas, but You know, there's no evidence of any of that. And the tragedy is, if you look at the central bankers of the world, most of them are not Jewish. And that's what Professor Quigley says in his book. The vast majority of the central bankers are not Jewish at all. Well, there are other people who are going to say, well, you don't understand. It's really the Council on Foreign Relations. Because since 1953, every chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, the head of the central bank in America, has come from the Council on Foreign Relations. Do you realize that every head of the Arms and Disarmament Agency in the United States since 1953 has come from the CFR? All but one Secretary of State, all but one Assistant Secretary of State, all but one Director of the CIA since 1953 has come from the Council on Foreign Relations. And furthermore, seven of the last nine presidents came from the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations is America's invisible government that's running the world. And people say, no. The Council on Foreign Relations just is for America. It's the Bilderbergers, because the Bilderbergers combines the people of great wealth in America and the socialists in America, and they work with the Europeans. So they meet on a regular basis, and they pick our presidents. And Bill Clinton was picked by the Bilderberger group. And people said, no. It's the Trilateral Commission, because that includes the people from the Orient and from Japan and from the Pacific Rim. And this is an international movement towards world control. And others are going to say, you don't understand, it's really communism. Communism is the real enemy. Most people think that communism is dead. Communism isn't dead. The whole fall of communism was a sham. In fact, Gorbachev had actually created the Green Cross Foundation in the United States, taken the papers out for it 6 months before the phony revolution over there. Communism is in full military production for war. Don't you know that? You hear how the soldiers are starving, but they're building new nuclear weapons and new mobile intercontinental missiles, and America's unilaterally disarming, and that doesn't make any sense. And China's in full production for war, and there are 1.25 billion people who live under communism in China, and our government is doing everything they can to help them. And most favored nation treaty status, but not just that. Do you realize that two-thirds of all the new industries going in there are financed by American corporations and American international banks? Communism's the enemy. And others will say, oh, that's not communism at all, it's socialism, because every communist is a socialist, and there's a socialist international out there, second, third most powerful organization in the world, and it has regular meetings, and the socialists throughout the world meet, and they work in conjunction with the communists to further their goals. And they say, oh, no, it isn't. That is the humanist, because every communist and every socialist is a humanist. And if you haven't read the Humanist Manifesto, they've laid the whole plan out for world domination, and they're socialists, and they want world government, and they're pro-abortion and pro-homosexual and pro-criminal and pro-drug, and it's the humanists. And then there's the people who say, oh no, it's the foundations. The great foundations of America, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, they're funding everything that's gone on in our society. They've been doing it for the last 100 years, and they're intent upon world government and socialism. And others will say, oh no, it's the Illuminati. It's the Illuminati. In fact, haven't you ever looked on the back of a dollar bill? You look on the back of that dollar bill, and what do you see there? You see the pyramid with the all-seeing eye over the top of that, and that's the symbol of the Illuminati. You see that? The number down underneath it says 1776, and that was the date that the Illuminati was founded. But the problem with that is that the great seal of the United States from which this occult emblem came, and it isn't a cult emblem, and that's not the eye of the god that we worship. That's the sun god. If you read occultist, that's the eye of Horus. That is the eye of Lucifer that's on the back of the dollar bill. But this design, at least the great eye, was actually suggested in 1790, just 4 years after the Illuminati was founded. It didn't have its tentacles into America at that time. This was actually put on the back of the Great Seal of the United States in 1782, just 6 years after the Illuminati was founded. And the 1776, from the very inception, when they were designing the Great Seal, had to do with the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The Illuminati was a very powerful force in Europe and infiltrated the Masonic lodges and played a part in the French Revolution. Others will say it's not the Illuminati, it's the Lucius Trust. If you've never heard of the Lucius Trust, it used to be called the Lucifer Trust. And this whole thing is Luciferian, and the Lucius Trust used to be right in the United Nations Plaza. And it's working today, and you'll find people like Robert Mueller and Theodore Hertzberg, formerly at Notre Dame, and many of our key and most important people in America are tied into the Lucius Trust, which used to be the Lucifer Trust, and it's all Luciferian. And others are going to say, no, you don't understand. It's the Masons. Do you realize that 14 American presidents have been Masons? Do you realize that people wonder why they took God out of our schools and God out of our public exhibits? Why we can't have four of the Supreme Court judges, of the six Supreme Court judges who voted to do that, were Masons, and the Masons have always supported separation of church and state in this wall of church and state because they worship a different God. And this indeed is a Masonic symbol. It isn't an Illuminati symbol. This is the Masons. And others are going to say, well, it isn't really the Masons, it's the New Age. The New Age has infiltrated every aspect of our life today. It's every place. If you haven't read the book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, you can get it, written by Marilyn Ferguson. And, you know, if you look on the front of that, the symbol of there is almost looks like three sixes intertwined. The New Age movement is certainly one of the most powerful movements in the world today. And then there's others who say, oh no, it's the oligarchy, it's the ruling houses of Europe. These are the royal blood that have been there for years, working behind the scenes, because one of them eventually will become the King of Jerusalem, who will be the Antichrist. And then there's the story of the Priory of Sion, which was supposedly a secret society that's been written about in a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and they claim that this secret society goes back to the bloodline of the union of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene. And of course, this is totally blasphemous, but there are many people who believe that the Priory, the Sion, and their Merovi or Merovian kings and Merovian lines go into the Habsburgs and into Prince Carlos of Spain, King Carlos of Spain. And then, of course, there are others who really believe that we're dealing with the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians come out of the mystery religions. It's a powerful secret society. It has branches right over in San Jose, in California, in the East, all throughout America. There are others who tell you it's the Skull and Bone Society. After all, George Bush came from there. William Buckley came from there. Ties into the Central Intelligence Agency, secret society out of Yale. Other people, of course, will tell you it's Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky's secret society. Has their headquarters up here at Ojai, back at Wheaton, Illinois. Has tentacles into every aspect of our society. There are others who tell you it's really the UFOs and those foreign little critters who are here beaming ideas down into our minds. And I'm reminded then of what Monsieur Perrault did as he analyzed what was happening on the Orient Express. And of course now they're trapped in a snowdrift, and he's talked to all of the various suspects. And every single one of them had a motive for killing this American. And of course, he is totally puzzled. There are too many clues. Everybody there has a motive. Well, as we look at what's going on in the world today, we are told, well, you know, if we could just control abortion, if you are a moral individual and you will spend your efforts to do something about the murder of the unborn throughout, not only in America, but throughout the world. This is the real problem, abortion. Or the real problem is homosexuality, and which manifests the breakdown in our society, or it's crime, or it's drugs, or it's education, or environment, or evolution, or all of these things are real, and they're real problems. Population control, immigration. But you see, these are all issues that are being put forth so that we will be on the defensive. And as long as we are on the defensive, we are going to continue losing this battle. And so let me take you into something I know something about, and perhaps we can, by analyzing Professor Carol Quigley and his writings, we can begin to understand what this whole incredible move towards world government is really all about. I got started this battle back in 1962. Cuba had just gone communist. Fidel Castro had been in America after the revolution. He had been lauded. He'd spoken to Congress. He had hugged Richard Nixon. He was going back from America to Cuba to fight communism, and then suddenly he was a communist, and that, something was wrong about that. I wasn't very smart at the time. I was just out of my orthopedic training. I was a busy young orthopedist in a community, now has about 10 orthopedists. I think there were two of us there at the time, and we were just working day and night. But I began to be fascinated by what was happening. I began reading, and first of all, I learned about communism and the fact that the communists controlled almost a third of the people and a third of the landmass of the world. And this was rather scary because you see country after country after country going communist, and Eastern Europe had gone communist after the Second World War, and China had gone communist. And How did it all happen? And then we began to read the book, and we have it back here on the table, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. We found that the great foundations had been working to influence the American people to bring communism to China and to bring socialism and communist ideas into America. And then we learned about the Council on Foreign Relations. And then in 1966, a little-known professor back at Georgetown University named Carol Quigley wrote a book. It was called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And it was a fascinating story because it talked about a secret society which had been organized and had led to the development of the Council on Foreign Relations. Even more intriguing was the story of what happened to that book, because it was initially published and distributed by Macmillan, and no sooner was it out than suddenly Macmillan was purchased by somebody else, and somebody destroyed the plates to the first half of the book. And, of course, there was a tremendous demand for the book. All the Birchers were reading it, and all the conservatives were reading it. And all over the world, people wanted the book, and, of course, it was unavailable because somebody had destroyed the plates in the first half of the book. Now, Professor Quigley was a liberal, and he saw nothing wrong with the secret society or any of the things he had uncovered. He just thought that people ought to know about it, and not only that, but he wanted the money that came from the royalties. And so he went to the publisher, and they lied to him. And for years, they lied to him about what had happened to the plates of the book. And when finally his wife got so mad that she went down and demanded to know what was happening, and they admitted the plates of the first half of the book had been destroyed, but they refused to ever publish the book in its entirety. They did republish the last half of the book, but it really didn't tell you much of anything. It had really no meaning. It's sort of like coming into a movie when it's two-thirds over and never knowing how it started. So, incidentally, if what I've told you sounds a little far out, we have a taped interview with Professor Quigley back there. I think we're just about out of them, but we have lots of them back home. It's in our secret government tapes, or you can get them separately. They're called the Carol Quigley tapes. And Carol Quigley will tell you just what I've told you. Well, Carol Quigley's story, in essence, was this. That back in 1870, there was a young man, and his name was Cecil John Rhodes, and he sat in a class at Oxford University, and he heard a talk given by a professor named John Ruskin. And John Ruskin was a dynamic speaker. And he talked about the British Empire and the obligation of the British aristocracy and art, because he was basically an art critic teacher. And he put them all together and talked about them all about morality. And he spoke in such wonderful and glowing terms that he touched the hearts and minds of literally dozens of his students. And many of them dedicated their entire lives to his dream. Now, John Ruskin used to read Plato every day. He believed in what Plato had written about the establishment of a world government under the rule of a ruling elite. That's what Plato really talked about in his Republic. He talked about the failings of democracy, but you wanted a ruling elite. And so Cecil Rhodes copied down in longhand what he heard that day in the lecture by John Ruskin, and he kept those words with him all of his life, and that became his purpose in life. He went off to Africa. He was able to buy the diamond and gold mines of Africa, and at a relatively young age, why, he was one of the wealthiest men in the world. Now, Cecil Rhodes then wrote a Confession of Faith in 1877. I've heard many stories about the Confession of Faith, but to my knowledge, I've only seen one other person who's ever actually had it. But we have it here, reduplicated. Actually, as Cecil Rhodes typed it out, he wasn't a very good typist, but you'll see his handwriting here in a few places. And this is the Confession of Faith, and what he basically said is the fact that why shouldn't we form a secret society to take over control of the world? The idea, gleaming and dancing before one's eyes like a will-o'-the-wisp, at last frames itself into a plan. Why should we not form a secret society with what one object? The furtherance of the British Empire, for the bringing of the whole uncivilized world under British rule, and the recovery of the United States, for the making of the Anglo-Saxon race, but one empire. And of course then, he attached this to the first of his seven wills. And actually, he attached that to the first five of his seven wills. And then he set out to recruit men to join this secret society. Well, of course, Rhodes was a ruthless individual. He was ruthless in dealing with people who thought he was his friends. He was ruthless with the natives of Africa. He would befriend some tribal chief and tell him, you know, what a great friend he was, and then he'd send the British troops in to slaughter the people. He went into the Transvaal Republic, the Orange Free State, and befriended the Afrikaners and then tried to create a revolution there in 1895. And finally, they got the Boer War going in 1899, and the Boer War was certainly one of the bloodiest wars. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a very, very small nation. The Afrikaners, there weren't that very many of them. But at the end of the war, there were 100,000 British casualties, and only 7,000 Boers were killed. One of the greatest tragedies of all time for the British. Well, we know a little bit from reading Tragedy and Hope, and that is that the secret society actually was formed. And in the inner core of that secret society, according to Professor Quigley, there were three men: William Stead, Lord Milner, and Lord Brett. Now, William Stead was the publicist, and he handled the propaganda in London, whipping up support for the war. Milner was the High Commissioner in South Africa, who promoted the war. And of course, Brett, who later came to be known as Lord Esher. Lord Esher was the advisor to the King of England. And of course then, so they used the king, they manipulated the king, they manipulated the press, and they had their war going. And of course, at the end of the war, Milner took over control of everything. Cecil Rhodes had died in 1902. And then, of course, Milner got together a group of young men who'd come to help him to rebuild. Now, they destroyed South Africa. They burned all the farms. They killed all the animals. They destroyed everything. And now they had to rebuild it after destroying it. And so a group of young aristocrats came from England, and they joined with Milner. They came to be known as Milner's Kindergarten. And then in 1909, they returned to England after rebuilding this nation that they destroyed to form something that was known as the Round Table. And the Round Table then operated as a front group for the secret society. And of course, it was operational then during the First World War. And although Professor Quigley doesn't really tell you, they were instrumental in creating the First World War. They were the dominant force in bringing England into that war. And the man who was primarily responsible was Sir Edward Grey, the British foreign minister, who, although Quigley denies it, was obviously part of their movement, and we can tell you later how we know that. Well then, of course, after the war, they've killed all the graduates of Harrow and Eton and Harvard, Oxford and Cambridge. They've lost a whole generation of the youth of England. And so they approach Americans at the Paris Peace Conference, and they say, you've got to take over leadership. I mean, we want to have world government under Anglo-Saxon domination. The only country that can do it is America. And then Professor Quigley tells us how the Council on Foreign Relations was formed out of these meetings. It's all there in the book. And of course, he tells how they took over the control of our banks and our foundations and our corporations, how they took over the control of our government. It's all in Tragedy and Hope, a history of the world in our time. No wonder somebody destroyed the plates to the first half of the book. Well, it's a fascinating summary. If you read pages 324 of the book, he tells you how the central banks are going to work to create a feudalistic system throughout the world. On page 325, he tells you the most carefully kept secret of banking, and that is that banks create money out of nothing. On page 866, he will tell you what the plan is. You're going to have elections. But it's not going to make any difference who you vote for, because they're going to control who gets elected. And they're going to number every one of you at birth. They're going to follow you through life, through your education, your service, maybe voluntary, maybe military, through your health insurance, your disability benefits, your old age benefits, and even the death benefits. And you're going to be totally controlled. Isn't that wonderful? And he thought that was really wonderful, because he looked upon us common people as the petty bourgeois. That was his term. The people who supported Barry Goldwater. He had total contempt for you and I, but he was brilliant. And we owe him a debt of gratitude. He was a genius. I mean, I poured through his papers weeks on end trying to understand this man and really what it was all about, what motivated him, what energized him. On pages 950, and of course his most famous statement, and I'm sure most of you have heard it, he just simply talks about how these foolish right-wingers believe that they're communists in the American government. And they thought that the communists were responsible for Eastern Europe going communist, and the communists were responsible for China going communist. And these right-wingers, these foolish, petty bourgeois, don't understand. This myth, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth. There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the Communist Act. In fact, this network, which we shall call the Roundtable Group, has no aversion to cooperating with communists, and often it does so. For I've studied this for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I've objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, but in general my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. On pages 1200 and 1201, he tells you that wars are not fought to win anymore. In fact, Bill Clinton, of course, was student there in 1966 during the Vietnam War, and Professor Quigley told him the truth. We don't go into wars to win them. We don't go into wars to defeat the enemy. We just go into wars to further our own interests, and we leave the other government intact so we'll have somebody to negotiate with. It is a little wonder that Bill Clinton, understanding what this war in Southeast Asia was totally a phony war, is it any... Should you be surprised that Bill Clinton didn't want to risk his life fighting in the jungles of Vietnam when he understood the power elite didn't want to win that war? An awful lot of brave men died, but what did they die for? For the limited aims of our power elite. Well, on pages 1247 and 1248, he lays it all out. He says, you know, we have a two-party system. But most people talk about a right and a left, a conservative and a liberal. There's a difference. No, you don't understand. What we need are both political parties just the same. So you can vote one party out as often as you want to. Vote out the rascals, but it doesn't make any difference because the same foreign and domestic policy continues. He had it all laid out in the book. Little wonder the plates in the first half of that book were destroyed. But this is not the first time. I can give you example after example of active suppression of books here within the United States. Well, 1972 came, and a book came out called None Dare Call It Conspiracy, and I'm sure most of you have read that. It was written by Larry Abraham and Gary Allen, and this took Professor Quigley's work, and then it sort of put a little twist on it, and part of that was, well, who's really responsible for this are the bankers, and they all have Jewish names, Rothschild, Goldman Sachs, you go down the line. But they never mention any of the other central bankers. The predominant number have nothing to do with being Jewish, but it sort of laid that background for anybody who talked about the conspiracy to say, well, they were anti-Semitic because, you know, and then they talk about the two classes of stock, you know, the A stock and the B stock, and the A stock's all owned by the Europeans, and they're getting all the money from all the interest that we're paying for bonds, and it's a great story, but if you study it, it just isn't true. And then, of course, I think the real crux of the book was that communism is controlled from New York City. And, of course, Nelson Rockefeller had gone to Russia, and they got rid of Khrushchev. The very weekend that he was over there, they got rid of Khrushchev, and you know what that means. And there were a lot of Americans who said, yeah, but it seems logical. I mean, we've financed communism since its very inception, and we have. There's no question. I mean, if you want to go in the background of financing communism, you haven't read Anthony Sutton's three-parts trilogy on Soviet Western technology and Soviet economic development put out by Hoover Institute, why, I mean, it's all there. We financed communism from its inception. You get hold of Herbert Hoover's memoirs, and of course he was in charge of relief during the immediately after the First World War. 95% of the relief efforts sent to Russia, massive amounts of food and medical supplies, and where did they go? To the communists. 5% went to the anti-communists. Now, that's hardly what you would expect if Russia was really a danger to America, and if the Russians were really trying to destroy capitalism, is it? It doesn't really make sense. If you read the biography of General Rangel, he was the commander of the Army of the South, fighting the communists who were advancing, and he was a white Russian, and the majority of the army didn't want communism. The majority of people in Russia did not want communism. But General Rangel made one serious mistake, And that is that he allowed himself to become dependent upon the British. And once they controlled his supply lines, they said, you will stop all further resistance. You will retreat to the Black Sea. You will be evacuated. And that's the end. And General Wrangel never understood what was going on. But what he didn't understand was that the English government at that time was totally controlled by Lord Milner and his people. Because in 1916, when Lloyd George was elected the Prime Minister of England, replacing the initial Asquith, who was the initial Prime Minister, got England into the war, and the English people wanted to get out of the war. What they didn't understand is that Lloyd George had a secretariat, and four of the six members of that secretariat just happened to come from the 20 or 30 people that were in the round table. And there was a war cabinet. Who was on the war cabinet? Why, Lord Milner and two other men. But the entire staff of the war cabinet, two of them were selected by Milner and two were selected by Lord Esher, or who was Brett, who was one of the three original members of the secret society. And of course, there was Brett, there was Lord Esher advising the King of England. It was all controlled, it was all contrived, and they fought four bloody years for a war that was fought simply to destroy the infrastructure of Europe, so that they could bring in the League of Nations and a new world government. And if you want to challenge that, we can give you some of the documentation on it. Well, anyway, this is an amazing, amazing story that Professor Quigley laid out in Tragedy and Hope. But the question was, how did he know it? I mean, if you read Tragedy and Hope, there's not one footnote. Not one. So, 1980, I decided I was going to find out what the basis of this was, and I went back to Georgetown, and I spent several weeks going through his files, and that's where I found the tape that we have, a taped interview with Professor Quigley where he tells you the story about how his publisher destroyed the plates in the first half of his book, and then he talks about the symbol on the back of the dollar bill, the occult symbol, and he says, you know, these crazy right-wingers are coming to me and they're telling me that that's the symbol of the Illuminati. He said, that isn't the symbol of the Illuminati. That symbol goes back 5,000 or 6,000 years. That symbol has been used in pagan and ancient and mystery religions for 5,000 years. And most people don't know that. Most people don't know where that symbol comes from and why it's significant that on the back of the American dollar bill, this symbol exists. Well, anyway, I went to Quigley's papers. And of course, how he found out about the secret society. I mean, how do you find out about a secret society when everybody's sworn to secrecy? Well, one man, in fact, there were three men who told us the story, or told him the story. Two men told him the story. One, a man we've tracked down on our own. And the first was Professor Zimmern. And about 1946, 47, Quigley was over in Europe studying the power structure of Great Britain, and he came across a man named Alfred Zimmern. He was a professor, and Alfred Zimmern told him that he had belonged to a secret society between 1910 and 1922. Now, if you read the book that was published the following year, The Anglo-American Establishment, we have it back there, Professor Quigley will tell you that the only way he could write about the secret society is because he knew somebody on the inside, but he never tells you who it was. The reason I know who it was is because I've got all of his papers. I copied them. Cost a fortune, but we've got volumes and volumes of these papers. All of his letters to Zimmern where they're trying to calculate who was in the secret society when it was first formed. And the letters from Zimmern to Quigley and Quigley to Zimmern. So Zimmern is the one who told him about it in the book The Anglo-American Establishment. Quigley says that Zimmern was in the secret society between 1910 and 1922. And the reason that Zimmern got out was, I mean, he was an idealist. He went into the secret society. He believed in the First World War. It was to change the world. It was to defeat the Germans. And, of course, the French were their allies. The Germans were the enemy. And he could go along with all the carnage and the horror of the war, although I'm sure it must have bothered him somewhat. It would bother any moral individual when you realize that there were about 21 million people killed, about 7.5 million soldiers, and about 12.5 million civilians, and probably twice that many injured and carrying the pain of their wounds to their death, maybe 50 or 60 million dead and wounded during the war. And I'm sure that must have bothered Zimmern, but Germany was the enemy and France was the ally. And then immediately after the First World War, suddenly the secret society shifted gears, and now Germany was the ally and France was the enemy, and that was too much for Professor Zimmern, so he dropped out. Now, he was afraid to talk about it, but he told Professor Quigley. And Professor Quigley then spent 20 years researching this. Now, there was one other man. His name was William G. Stead. You remember there were three people in the secret society, Stead and Milner and Brett. How do we know that? Well, fortunately, Stead was thrown out of the secret society because he didn't really believe in the Boer War. And so he wrote about it in his diary. And we have the pages from his diary back there, or some of them are reduplicated in This is America, Death of a Dictatorship, because I've simply taken many of these books and taken the important pages out. And Stead actually talks about how they sat around at his home at Mulberry House in 1891 and plotted how they were going to create the secret society. And then, of course, he has the letters from Rhodes to him in about 1900, talking about the secret society, and he republished those in a book called The Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes. So there's no question at all the secret society was formed, and here we have Stead attesting to it. We have Professor Zimmern attesting to it, and one other man. His name was H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells had actually spent a great deal of time with the members of the secret society. And if you read Wells' great book, it's entitled An Experiment in Autobiography. And Wells tells you that between 1902 and 1908, there were a number of men who met together at a dinner club. And there was Lord Milner. There was Leopold Amory. And the name may not mean much to you, but Amory would have been part of Milner's kindergarten, part of a round table. And he was the man who, in 1939, stood up as a member of Parliament, pointed at Chamberlain and said, "You've been here too long, go." That was what they'd said to Cromwell several hundred years before. And, of course, Chamberlain resigned, and, of course, that brought in Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was part and parcel of this movement. How do we know? Well, first of all, because we have a letter that he wrote to H.G. Wells. We got it out of the Wells Library back at University of Chicago, I think it is, where Churchill says to Wells, "I really can't talk about this outside of this secret circle." Well, Wells, who was in the secret society? Well, there was, in the coefficients that met every week or so for, 6 years, 1902 to 1908. There was Milner, Lord Grey, who was the foreign minister who took England into the war, Lord Brand, who was the CEO of Lazard Brothers, so-called international Jewish banking house. Actually, it was controlled by a member of the Round Table, just as in the United States, Lehman Brothers. Boy, doesn't that sound Jewish? Who was headed by Pete Peterson, a Greek who became chairman of the board of the Council on Foreign Relations for many years. And so they keep those Jewish names out there, and they do it intentionally, so that your attention will be diverted from what this is really all about. But so many of these organizations are actually headed by people who tie into this secret society who are not Jewish at all. So let's then we had Lord Cecil, and so there were actually five people on one side, and they were all part of the British aristocracy. They were the ruling elite, and three of them, Brand, Milner, and Leopold Amory, were all part of the Round Table group. On the other side, you had H.G. Wells, you had George Bernard Shaw, you had Bertrand Russell, you had Sidney and Beatrice Webb, and you had the founders of the Fabian Socialists. And they plotted for a number of years how they would bring about a one-world socialist government. In fact, coming out of those meetings, Wells wrote two books. One, The Open Conspiracy, and said, "We're going to be in charge of Moscow probably long before we control New York. We're going to create a one-world government, just exactly as they have in Russia, with socialism. The bankers are going to help us." This is The Open Conspiracy by H.G. Wells. The other was a book called The New World Order, in which he talked about how the one-world government was coming. Both of these books, according to Wells, in his book, An Experiment in Autobiography, actually came out of those meetings between the ruling aristocracy of England, who were tied into the secret society, and the Fabian Socialists. So you saw the socialists from below and the other people from above, and of course Brand tied into banking, Milner was tied into banking, people, and Cecil, Lord Cecil was there, was tied into banking. The most powerful men in England were plotting with the Fabian Socialists on how they would bring socialism. Why did they want socialism? Isn't socialism going to take from the rich and give to the poor? No, it's going to bring everybody under the control of the rich. That's what it's really all about, because they always will control the government buying and selling politicians. They did it in England, and they've done it in America. Socialism is said to be a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory. But it doesn't work without force. And somebody's going to be in control of that socialist society. And even Karl Marx, when he wrote the Communist Manifesto, talked about the dictatorship not by the proletariat, but of the proletariat. It was a dictatorship by which the common people would be controlled. And that's really what they were planning on. But H.G. Wells wrote another book. It was called The New Machiavellis. And it was a story, now in novel form, admittedly, but it was a story of a secret society that was headed by a German. It was an English secret society that controlled the English government that was headed by a German. And, of course, Lord Milner was a German. I mean, he was a British citizen, but he was a German extraction. And, of course, only fictional, except that Leo Amery, in his diary, refers to that book, and he says, and we have Leo Amery's diary, and he says, hey, H.G. Wells was talking about our group. That was us. So here we have three people who attest to the formation of a secret society in England. Then we have an American. His name was Frederick Howe. And Frederick Howe was at the Paris peace negotiations after the carnage of Europe had come to an end. And he was a real idealist. I mean, he was one of these head-in-the-clouds liberals who could justify the First World War because England had to honor a 50-year-old treaty with Belgium where England promised that they would defend Belgium if attacked. And so treaties were sacred, and if treaties weren't honored, how would we ever have world peace through world law? How would we ever have the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World? And so Frederick Howe was there in England with Colonel House, and Head Howe was one of the chief men in this whole movement. It was called the Inquiry. And there you saw Thomas Lamont, who was a partner in J.P. Morgan, and you have John Foster Dulles, and Alan Dulles was there. Christian Herter, you remember Christian Herter became Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State, Alan Dulles head of the CIA. But all these men, this was 1919. But Howe was there too. And he was asked to go over all of the treaties dealing with Palestine, the Palestine area. And because he was actually President Wilson and House wanted him to enter and help with the American input on the negotiations. What did he find? Well, he found, first of all, that the English, who gone into the war because they believed in treaties, world rules, the world law, and treaties were sacred, almost like the Bible, the English had first of all promised the Arabs that if they came in on the English side, that they'd give them Palestine. Then they made a secret treaty with the French, and they promised that they'd give the French Palestine. And then they promised to give, through the Balfour Declaration, the Jews Palestine. And they'd given Palestine to three different groups. And suddenly Frederick Howe realized they don't believe in treaties at all. It's all been for nothing. All these people have died. This carnage, this horror. I mean, you talk about warfare. I mean, what happened on the Western Front and the bayonet charges, the trench warfare. Four bloody horrible years, if you've ever read into the stories of the people who were there. Horrible, horrible, horrible carnage. It had all been for nothing. And so Frederick Howe said, what was it really all about? And so Frederick Howe thought, well, it has to do with economic imperialism. Maybe it had to do with commercial interests, so that the British would be able, commercial interests would have a better trading advantage over the Germans. Maybe that was what it was about. And then he said that a group of men came to him. They were known as Lord Milner's men, and he named them. They were the men who surrounded the Prime Minister at that time. This is 1919. The Prime Minister of England is Lloyd George. And they said to Frederick Howe, you know, we've got to get you to join with us to create this world government. This is what it's all about. And he said, you know, they didn't even know the meaning of the term economic imperialism. And they told him the war had nothing to do with economic imperialism. It had to do with the white man's burden to rule the world. The white man has to rule the world. That's our obligation. That's our destiny. And that's why the war had to be fought to its conclusion. Because without that, they wouldn't have destroyed the existing social structure of Europe. It's all their confessions of a reformer. But of course, you're never going to hear most of these things from Ted Koppel or Dan Rather or Barbara Walters. Well, they have one other person who will attest to what this is really all about, Admiral Chester Ward. Admiral Ward is quoted in Barry Goldwater's excellent book. Actually, we have the quotation in here, or you can get it from Kissinger on the Couch, which Chester Ward wrote with Phyllis Schlafly. And Admiral Ward, 16 years in the Council on Foreign Relations, finally came out and said, look, he said, This is what it's all about. There is a small clique within this organization that is totally dedicated to the destruction of national sovereignty, and they're totally dedicated to world government. And of course, he felt this was terrible. He was a man, a member of the military, a judge advocate general of the Navy, who really believed in America's independent state. And he realized the Council on Foreign Relations was being used to program people to support this internationalist dream for the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. So how then does this all tie together? Well, Monsieur Perrault, as he was looking at all of the suspects, realized that in the dead man's body there were 12 stab wounds, and there were 12 suspects, every one of whom had a motive to kill the American. And he said, there are too many clues, 12 stab wounds, 12 people, all with a motive. Well, as we look at what's going on in the world today, how do we begin to put this together? And so let's just take what Professor Quigley has told us about the origins of the Council on Foreign Relations, and let's go back to Cecil John Rhodes. Who was he really? What motivated Cecil John Rhodes? And what most people do not understand is Cecil Rhodes had entered the Masonic Lodge. He had sworn the oaths of fidelity to the light. Now, how many of you here, well, I won't ask that, because probably most of you know what the light is in Masonry, but if you go into the Blue Lodge of Masonry, the first thing you do is they blindfold you, they put a noose around your neck, they bare your chest here, and then they roll up your pant leg, and then they march you up before the worshipful master, and they say, what do you most want? And you're told you're supposed to say the light. So you say the light. And then you go into the second level of the lodge, and they say, what do you most want? And you're supposed to say more light. And then the third level of the lodge, why, you want even more light. But you never know what the light is. Nobody ever tells you. In fact, you're told as you go up to the levels of the lodge that they're going to tell you the secret. Trouble is that they never tell you the secret. You may catch a glimpse of this as you read the esoteric writings of Masonry, but most people within the Masonic Lodge are intentionally deceived. And if you read Morals and Dogma, written by Albert Pike, he will tell you, we intentionally deceive people coming into the lodge. Why? Because we don't want them to know. Most of them are not worthy to know the real secret. If you read Manly Hall, now, Albert Pike died in 1891. During the 20th century, the leading Masonic philosopher is a man named Manly P. Hall. In fact, he had his headquarters right down here in the Los Angeles area. I don't know if you know of it, but Manly P. Hall had written extensively on Masonry before he ever joined the Lodge. Became a 33rd degree Mason, one of the leading Masonic philosophers. And he said, Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity. Most Masons are wonderful people. They have a good time. They do good things. But there is an inner fraternity dedicated to the mystery, to the secrets. And of course, Manly Hall wrote extensively on what those secrets were. And of course, unless you understand those secrets, you can't understand what energized Cecil John Rhodes, or why the symbol is on the back of the American dollar bill. What does that symbol really stand for? What does it really mean? And why is nobody concerned that that symbol is on the back of the dollar bill? Well, first of all, you can read what the occultists will tell you. They will tell you that the pyramid has to do with pagan rites. And in pagan rites, for the last 5,000 to 6,000 years, the pyramid has been the symbol. It's got 13 steps on it. It has nothing to do with 13 colonies. 13 is a secret occult number that gives tremendous power. The term above, which I can't pronounce, but it has to do with he favors our venture, the novus aurora seclorum, has to do with the new social order, the new order of the ages, 1776, they will tell you, has to do with the date when America was created. And the all-seeing eye above is the eye of the God, of the sun, the eye of light. Well, Cecil Rhodes, after going and entering the Masonic Lodge and hearing the lecture by John Ruskin, suddenly became consumed with this idea that it was his destiny to create a one-world government. Now, we knew he'd never live to see it come to pass, but he believed that he would form the foundation for this one-world government. And he began then to recruit men to his cause. You remember there were three men initially. There was William Stead, there was Lord Esher, his name was Brett, and there was Lord Milner. Stead was an occultist. He was a member of the Theosophical organization. He was deeply involved in spiritualism. Why was he interested in getting into an organization with Cecil Rhodes? Because occultists, and you read occult writings, they will all tell you, we're moving towards a new age, we're moving towards a new one-world government, we're moving towards a new spirituality. If you read the material which we have, read Carol Quigley's book, read the pages from White's book, actually taken from Stead's diary, you'll find out that the second level of the secret society was a man named Lord Balfour, Arthur Balfour. And Arthur Balfour had formed the Society for Psychical Research. And Professor Quigley tells us in his book, The Anglo-American Establishment, that the men who joined with Milner after Cecil Rhodes' death primarily came from the Society for Psychical Research. They were all into the occult. And this is the common denominator behind everything that's going on. If you go into the Council on Foreign Relations today, you'll be amazed to find how many of these men are into the Lucius Trust, are into Theosophy, are into Masonry, and the underlying focus of everything that's going on today is occultism working within every one of these organizations. Now, most people think communism is an atheistic form of philosophy. In other words, Karl Marx was an atheist. He talked about religion being the opiate of the masses. Then most people are usually incredibly naive. Karl Marx was a Satanist. And if you haven't read the book, Marx and Satan by Reverend Warren Brown, who spent 14 years in a communist prison, you have to, and we carry that through our ministry. And Marx and Proudhon and Bakunin, who were the three leading socialists at that time, were all into Satanism, and they embraced socialism as a means of destroying Christian civilization. Western civilization, that's what it was really all about. Mikhail Gorbachev today is a New Ager. You go to his State of the Union, State of the World Forums in San Francisco or down in Mexico, and the whole theme is occultism. And what does Mikhail Gorbachev talk about? What we need is a one world order, a new world order, and a new world spirituality. At the recent conference that was held in Rio de Janeiro, it was called the Earth Summit Plus 5 or whatever the original meeting was there in 1992. They had a new one earlier this year in 1997. And they're stressing new spirituality. What are they talking about? They're talking about doing away with the Judeo-Christian ethic and replacing it with a new world religion. If you get into the background of Masonry and you begin studying what the Masonic philosophers will tell you about the light, if you read Albert Pike, and he actually goes into some detail talking about, and here I think on page 321, he says, Lucifer, the light bearer. Strange the mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness. Lucifer, the son of the morning. Is it he who bears the light? Doubt it not. Lucifer is the god of Masonry. And if you doubt that, we can give you all sorts of references, but probably Manly Hall is the best source of that. And his quotation is really very, very clear. And he basically talks about the strength of a man was not given to be used destructively, but that he might build a temple worthy to be the dwelling place of the great architect of the universe. When the Mason learns that the key is the proper application of the dynamo of living power, he shall have understood the mystery of the craft and the seething energies of Lucifer in his hands. And that comes from his book, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry. It's all Luciferian. That's the driving force behind Masonry and Theosophy and the Lucius Trust, behind Communism, behind the Council on Foreign Relations. Behind all of this is Luciferianism. Of course, here we're out there, we're trying to, you know, elect people to public office, and we're going to, you know, we're going to save things, we're going to save America, because we're going to elect Bob Dole to the president. He's a 33rd degree Mason. And so is Jack Kemp ran with him, and they were running against Bill Clinton, who comes from the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers. You know, did you ever give a sucker an even chance? This symbol is the symbol of the mystery religions.